Hi everyone, it's Kelly Thacker. I'm excited to be with you for another lesson. Today we are in Mosiah 7 through 10. So here's the points from our Come Follow Me lesson. Jesus Christ has the power to deliver me. I was created after the image of God. The Lord provides prophets, seers, and revelators to benefit mankind. I can face my challenges in the strength of the Lord, and my choices can influence generations. So before we jump in, let's have a review to figure out where we are in both history and geography. So in about 200 BC, Mosiah the First fled with righteous Nephites north to Zarahemla. They discovered the people of Zarahemla, and we call them the Mulekites. You don't find that word in the Book of Mormon, but we call them the Mulekites. Mosiah the First is made king over them. Mulekites had discovered Coriantumr, the last of the Jaredites, and Mosiah translated their stone record. So why should readers pay close attention to the Mulekites? Why do we care? Let's watch this Know Why video.
Most readers of the Book of Mormon are familiar with the Nephites and the Lamanites, but sometimes it's easy to forget about the Mulekites and the important role that they played. Their identity is not immediately clear in the text and can only be pieced together from isolated passages. This may cause readers to assume that the Mulekites were of little concern in the sweeping history of the Nephites and Lamanites, yet a careful reading suggests that the Mulekites were very influential, both politically and religiously. Readers are introduced to the Mulekites, who are also called the people of Zarahemla, when the Nephites discovered them and absorbed them into their community. The Book of Mormon states that they came out from Jerusalem at the time that Zedekiah, king of Judah, was carried away captive into Babylon. This would mean that they left Jerusalem about the same time as Lehi's group. We learn that Zarahemla was a descendant of Mulek and those who came with him into the wilderness. Yet not until much later do readers learn that Mulek was actually the son of Zedekiah, the king of Judah, and that he was Zedekiah's only son who wasn't slain when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians. One reason the Mulekites are important is that they help settle the fundamental conflict between the Nephites and Lamanites. The Nephites believe that God called Nephi to be a prophet and a ruler. The Lamanites, on the other hand, believed that Nephi was a false prophet and that he robbed their ancestors of their inheritance. However, the origin story of the Mulekites validates the Nephite tradition by proving that Nephi and Lehi correctly prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem. The story of the Mulekites also illustrates why the scriptures are so important. The Nephites brought the plates of brass with them across the ocean. The Mulekites, on the other hand, didn't bring any scriptures. As a result, they suffered a significant spiritual decline after dwelling only a few generations in the New World. Their language became corrupted, and they denied the being of their creator. These circumstances may help explain why the Mulekites were so willing to join with the Nephites in the first place. By doing so, they gained access to the scriptures and solidified their religious and cultural identity. This example shows how the absence of the scriptures in our lives can have a rippling effect throughout the generations. It also helps us understand why prophets have invited us to read from the scriptures, especially from the Book of Mormon, every day. Doing so will help us obtain enduring faith in God and Christ. And now you know why.
So I find that really interesting because the Mulekites validated the Nephites' prophecy, or Lehi's and Nephi's prophecies, that Jerusalem was destroyed. Didn't make any difference with Laman and Lemuel and the Lamanites, but they did. Most Latter-day Saints refer to the people of Zarahemla as the Mulekites, although the word Mulekite does not appear a single time in the Book of Mormon. The people of Zarahemla were descendants of a colony of people who left Jerusalem about 589 BC at the time of the Babylonian captivity, included in this colony was Mulek, the ancestor of Zarahemla, and one of the sons of Zedekiah, the king of Judah. It is interesting to note that although the progenitors of Mosiah's group and of the people of Zarahemla left Jerusalem within about 12 years of each other and evidently spoke the same language then, yet about 400 years later, their descendants could not even understand each other. The reason for this is that the language of the people of Zarahemla had become corrupted because they had brought no records with them, and they denied the being of their creator. King Mosiah caused his language to be taught to the natives of Zarahemla, after which they secured from Zarahemla an oral genealogy. The Coriantumr, who lived with the people of Zarahemla for a short period, was the last military leader of the Jaredite nation. Coriantumr lived with the people of Zarahemla sometime after 589 BC, when the colony of Mulek first left Jerusalem, and before about 200 BC, when Mosiah and his group first came into the land of Zarahemla. The 20th verse of Omni tells of a large stone that was brought to Mosiah and which contained an account of Coriantumr. In Mosiah chapter 6, we read, "And it came to pass that King Benjamin, son of Benjamin," who was the son of Mosiah the first, that's just inserted there, "he did walk in the ways of the Lord, and did observe his judgments and his statutes, and did keep his commandments in all things whatsoever he commanded him." While King Mosiah's people, that was a little review of where we are up to this point. But before we jump into chapter 7, here's a preview of what's going to be happening in today's lesson. This is from the Come Follow Me manual. While King Mosiah's people were enjoying continual peace in Zarahemla, their thoughts turned to another group of Nephites who many years before had left to dwell in the land of Lehi Nephi. Generations had passed, and Mosiah's people had heard nothing from them. So Mosiah asked Ammon to lead a search party to find the Nephites who had left. The search party found that these Nephites, because of their iniquity, were in captivity to the Lamanites. But with the arrival of Ammon and his brethren, suddenly there was hope for deliverance. So there's your preview of today's lesson. So with the background and with that preview, we are ready to start chapter 7 in verse 1. "And now it came to pass that after King Mosiah had had continual peace for the space of 3 years, he was desirous to know concerning the people who went up to dwell in the land of Lehi Nephi or in the city of Lehi Nephi, for his people had heard nothing from them from the time they left the land of Jerusalem. Therefore they wearied him with their teasings. And it came to pass that King Mosiah granted that 16 of their strong men might go up to the land of Lehi Nephi to inquire concerning their brethren." And so that we know what's going on, I'm a visual person, and I like this map. Now remember, the church has never stated anything regarding where they think it took place. And they ask that people don't be contentious about it, but people are incredibly contentious about where they think it took place. Most scholars are comfortable with Mesoamerica, but still, the Lord has not said, the church has not said. So this is a generic map that we use, and it's a really good one, but it just is a map, but it's not in a specific place. So that we know what's going on, remember that during King Benjamin's reign, a group of Nephites under the leadership of a man named Zenith left the land of Zarahemla to regain part of the land of Nephi. About 79 years after this group left Zarahemla to regain part of the land of Nephi, King Mosiah II, the grandson of the first King Mosiah, wanted to know what had happened to this group. He permitted a man named Ammon to lead an expedition for this purpose. Now, I know I'm just repeating what we just said, but all of this, the more you repeat it, the more it sticks in your brain, the more it makes sense. So this Ammon, I just want to make a note, he's not the son of Mosiah, who later preached the gospel among the Lamanites, the dude who cut off all the arms. This is not that Ammon. Okay, so I like this chart because it shows the chain of who kept the records and how they were passed down. So we've seen this, Tim showed this last week. And you can see Lehi down to Nephi, his son, and then over to his brother. I find it interesting, we read nothing in the Book of Mormon about any posterity Nephi may have had. Because why wouldn't he have passed it to his son? He did it. He passed it to Jacob. Well, probably because Jacob was right there with Nephi. in his spirituality, and he had seen the Savior like Nephi. That might have been Nephi's reasoning, but we don't know. So then Jacob passes it down to his posterity. Enos, Jerem, Omni, Amaron, and then Amaron over to his brother Chemish, then down to Abinadab, Amalekite, who then takes it over to Benjamin, where we are now. So we had King Mosiah the first, then his son Benjamin, then King Mosiah the second, and that's where we are in today's lesson. Now, back in chapter 7, verse 3, and it came to pass that on the morrow they started to go up, having with them one Ammon, he being a strong and mighty man, and a descendant of Zarahemla, and he was also their leader. And now they knew not the course they should travel in the wilderness to go up to the land of Lehi-Nephi. Therefore they wandered many days in the wilderness, even 40 days did they wander. And when they had wandered 40 days, they came to a hill which is north of the land of Shilom, and there they pitched their tents. Just please note that 40 is not exact. 40 is used throughout scripture to indicate a long period of time. Okay, that's 40. And here is where Shilom is on the map, down here. Okay. And Ammon took three of his brethren, and their names were Amaleki, Helam, and Hem, and they went down into the land of Nephi. And behold, they met the king of the people who were in the land of Nephi and in the land of Shilom. And they were surrounded by the king's guard and were taken and were bound and were committed to prison. And it came to pass when they had been in prison 2 days, they were again brought before the king, and their bands were loosed, and they stood before the king and were permitted, or rather commanded, that they should answer the questions which he should ask them. And he said unto them, behold, I am Limhi, the son of Noah, who was the son of Zenoph, who came out of the land of Zarahemla to inherit this land, which was the land of their fathers, who was made a king by the voice of the people. So Ammon has found out what happened to Zenoph, because this is his grandson. And now when Ammon saw that he was permitted to speak, he went forth and bowed himself before the king. And rising again, he said, O king, I am very thankful before God this day that I am yet alive and am permitted to speak. And I will endeavor to speak with boldness. For I am assured that if ye had known me, ye would not have suffered that I should have worn these bands. For I am Ammon, and am a descendant of Zarahemla, and have come up out of the land of Zarahemla to inquire concerning our brethren, whom Zenoph brought up out of that land. And now it came to pass that after Limhi had heard the words of Ammon, he was exceedingly glad, and said, Now I know of a surety that my brethren who were in the land of Zarahemla are yet alive. And now I will rejoice, and on the morrow I will cause that my people shall rejoice also. For behold, we are in bondage to the Lamanites, and are taxed with a tax which is grievous to be borne. And now, behold, our brethren will deliver us out of our bondage, or out of the hands of the Lamanites, and we will be their slaves. For it is better that we be slaves to the Nephites than to pay tribute to the king of the Lamanites. So what does this reveal about Limhi's qualities as a leader? He doesn't care about his throne. His people's safety, righteousness, and happiness were more important to him, apparently, than power. So he's a good guy. Let's watch this. Why are Mormon's extensive quotations of Limhi significant?
As Mormon compiled the Book of Mosiah, he included quite a few quotations from the King Limhi. Limhi was the son of the wicked King Noah. He was not a prophet, and he did not come from a particularly respectable family. So why did Mormon bother including Limhi's teachings? Though he had a questionable origin, Limhi was considerably different from his father in matters of education and faith. The quotes show a man who spent a great deal of time reading the spiritual and historical records of his people. This record of Limhi, preserved by Mormon for us, shows an example of how sincere scripture study can change one's nature and destiny. We need look no further than Limhi for reasons to be serious about studying our scriptures, and now you know why.
And now King Limhi commanded his guards that they should no more bind Ammon nor his brethren, but caused that they should go to the hill which was north of Shilom, and bring their brethren into the city, that thereby they might eat and drink and rest themselves from the labors of their journey. For they had suffered many things. They had suffered hunger, thirst, and fatigue. So Limhi is convinced they are alone with no help. They are as close to slaves as they can get. They are looking at Ammon and his men to deliver them. Now it came to pass on the morrow that King Limhi sent a proclamation among all his people, that thereby they might gather themselves together to the temple to hear the words which he should speak unto them. This is the first reference to a temple in the land of Lehi Nephi. The two earlier temples mentioned in the Book of Mormon were located in the land of Nephi and in the land of Zarahemla. No further information is provided in our present Book of Mormon concerning when or by whom this temple in the land of Lehi Nephi was first constructed. And it came to pass that when they had gathered themselves together, that he, Limhi, okay, spake unto them in this wise, saying, O ye my people, lift up your heads and be comforted, for behold, the time is at hand, or is not far distant, when we shall no longer be in subjection to our enemies, notwithstanding our many strugglings, which have been in vain, yet I trust there remaineth an effectual struggle to be made. Therefore, lift up your heads and rejoice, and put your trust in God, in that God who is the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and also that God who brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, and caused that they should walk through the Red Sea on dry ground, and fed them with manna that they might not perish in the wilderness, and many more things did he do for them. And again, that same God has brought our fathers out of the land of Jerusalem, and has kept and preserved his people even until now. And behold, it is because of our iniquities and abominations that he has brought us into bondage. And ye are all witnesses this day that Zenith, who was made king over this people, he being overzealous, hang on to that. This is a very big part of today's lesson. Zenith was being overzealous to inherit the land of his fathers, therefore being deceived by the cunning and craftiness of King Laman, who, having entered into a treaty with King Zenith, and having yielded up into his hands the possessions of a part of the land, or even the city of Lehi Nephi, and the city of Shilom, and the land round about, and all this he did for the sole purpose of bringing this people into subjection or into bondage. And behold, we at this time do pay tribute to the king of the Lamanites, to the amount of one half of our corn and our barley, and even all our grain of every kind, and one half of the increase of our flocks and our herds, and even one half of all we have or possess, the king of the Lamanites doth exact of us, or our lives. Yeah, you give or you die. Now, wait a minute. He mentions barley. Well, everyone knows barley was never found in the Americas. The Book of Mormon must be untrue, and Joseph Smith was a fraud, right? And that's an argument. There's one of the anti's argument. Let me read this, though. The Book of Mormon mentions barley. This is from a BYU Studies article by Tyler Livingston. So, new evidence, all right? The Book of Mormon mentions barley several times, but was thought for years that it was not introduced to the Americas until brought by the Europeans. In 1887, M.T. Lamb wrote, "It is a somewhat stubborn fact that barley was never found upon either of these western continents until imported by Europeans in modern times." This was a popular argument until 1983, when domesticated barley was found in Arizona. You're thinking, okay, well, that's Arizona. Okay, let's continue on. This argument may have affected many people's testimony in the previous 100 years of it being found. Dr. Lund mentions a story of just this happening. He writes about an LDS horticulture student working on a PhD at the University of Washington during the 70s, who during his research learned that there was no pre-Columbian barley in the New World prior to the Spaniards' arrival. This came in conflict with his beliefs about the Book of Mormon, since it specifically mentions barley. Dr. Lund counseled this young man not to lose your faith in what you know because of what you don't know. Just because science has not caught up with the claims of the Book of Mormon does not make it untrue. In time, the Lord will see fit to reveal more and more evidences and insights pertaining to the Book of Mormon. Despite that counsel, the horticulture student left the church because he could not reconcile what man had discovered at that point in time with what a spiritual witness was telling him. And that's really sad, isn't it? And you're seeing that today. Oh my gosh, you are seeing that today. If he would have held out, relying on faith a few more years, he would have been rewarded with the knowledge of pre-Columbian barley's discovery in Arizona, as well as several other sites all over the United States and Mexico. The Hohokam, who lived in Arizona, where domesticated barley was first found in 1983, are thought to have been in trade with those in Middle America, as evidenced by an abundance of ball courts and platform mounds, cultures reigning far to the south, clearly influenced the Hohokam. Most of the cultures of the Midwest eventually cultivated little barley for food. Not like as in not very much barley, meaning small, little barley. And we know that food was part of the trade between Mesoamerica and Eastern North America. Okay, let's watch this. I found this really, really fascinating. More about this Book of Mormon evidence of barley. This is from Book of Mormon Central.
Question: How can patience transform a seeming anachronism like barley into food for faith?
Sometimes the Book of Mormon references things which seem out of place. The text says the Nephites grew barley, but everybody knows barley wasn't grown in the Americas until it was brought here by Europeans.
Are you sure about that?
Well, that's what doubters have doggedly proclaimed, even as far back as the 19th century. One said, "It is a somewhat stubborn fact that barley was never found upon either of these Western continents until imported by Europeans in modern times." Another boldly stated, "If this alone is a mistake, the Book of Mormon must be false."
That was the scholarly consensus for over a century. But new research and discoveries have offered fresh illumination.
What do you mean?
Scholars have long known that there are several varieties of wild barley in the Americas. So claims that it wasn't here at all were always uninformed. The real question is whether it was ever cultivated, as suggested in verses like Mosiah 9:9. That is, planted and harvested.
Okay, so what about that?
That remained unproven until the 1980s, when archaeologists made a surprising discovery amidst the ancient Hohokam culture of Arizona. In 1983, science writer Daniel B. Adams reported that perhaps the most startling evidence of Native American agricultural sophistication came last year when salvage archaeologists found preserved grains of what looked like domesticated barley, the first ever found in the New World.
Wow.
Moreover, archaeologists Michael T. Dunn and William Green declared, "Extensive archaeological evidence points to the cultivation of little barley in the Southwest and parts of Mexico. Samples have now been found in ancient sites throughout North America, including Iowa, Illinois, Oklahoma, and elsewhere, where it was preserved with remains of other domesticated seeds. This crop has been farmed and harvested for thousands of years."
That puts it right in Book of Mormon times.
V.L. Borer, the archaeologist working in Arizona, wrote, "It is reasonable to conclude that we are looking at a North American domesticated crop whose existence has not previously been suspected."
What about further south?
Long-distance trade between the Maya and other Mesoamerican cultures with tribes of the southwestern U.S. and Mississippi Valley is well documented. It's apparently how maize, or corn, migrated northward. The extent to which little barley was traded and dispersed, north or south, is still unfolding.
Nevertheless, we now have pre-Columbian barley.
Check.
That archaeologists say was cultivated.
Check.
Back to the time of the Nephites.
Check. And of course, the first record that pointed this out, the Book of Mormon.
That's incredible.
So, the moral of the story.
Hold it. I got this. Patience matters. Keep searching, and good things can come to those who wait.
That's the evidence. You decide.
I really love that. So many things about the Book of Mormon have been criticized. And then they found out that, later science proved it, or archaeological evidence would come forth. So after King Limhi has lamented this tribute they have to pay to the Lamanites, half of everything, he goes on to say in verse 23, "And now is not this grievous to be borne? And is not this our affliction great? Now behold, how great reason we have to mourn. Yea, I say unto you, great are the reasons which we have to mourn. For behold, how many of our brethren have been slain, and their blood has been spilt in vain, and all because of iniquity. For if this people had not fallen into transgression, the Lord would not have suffered that this great evil should come upon them. But behold, they would not hearken unto his words, and there arose contentions among them, even so much that they did shed blood among themselves. Let's watch this. How do the covenants in the scriptures apply to me today?
In the Book of Mormon, we read about the Zenophites who suffered many afflictions due to their wickedness. Many of these afflictions are the same ones promised to the Israelites if they broke their covenants. The many parallels between the Book of Mormon and books like Deuteronomy are not only a subtle evidence for the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, but also help to show that God's covenants always apply, regardless of time and space. Examples of the parallels between the Israelites and the people of Zenith include their flocks being taken away, their crops being smitten and devoured by insects, the people being slain, devoured by wild beasts, and cursed with pestilence, blindness, diseases, and many more parallels. From these accounts, we can see how the Lord's covenants, and in this case, curses, were fulfilled. Part of the stated function of the Book of Mormon in its title page is that its peoples would know the covenants of the Lord. While this video has focused on the curses of breaking sacred covenants, we can know that the Lord is just as true to His word with the blessings of keeping covenants. And now you know why.
And that's what he was saying, is Zenith, who is his grandfather, he brought us into this. And then they didn't keep their covenants, and now we're in transgression. So let's go back to verse 25. King Limhi says, if they had not fallen into transgression, for if this people had not fallen into transgression, the Lord would not have suffered that this great evil should come upon them. This is where being obedient and keeping our covenants comes in. Being obedient is like a gift to God. Through our obedience and keeping our covenants, we show Him we love Him. We have protection when we are obedient. Now, I'm going to tell a story about Wilford Woodruff, because he tells of an experience when he did not obey the voice of the Spirit, because he was a righteous man, obviously. And being righteous, we are entitled to promptings from the Spirit. He didn't listen. I will now give an example from my own experience of the result of not obeying the voice of the Spirit. Some years since, I had part of my family living in Randolph, Rich County, Utah. I was there on a visit with my team of horses in the month of December. One Monday morning, my monitor, the Spirit, watching over me, called him his monitor, I love that, said, "Take your team and go home to Salt Lake City." When I named it to my family, who were at Randolph, they urged me strongly to stop longer. "Oh, don't go yet. You're fine. We all know more than the Spirit, right?" We're going to talk about that a little, too. Through their persuasion, I stayed until Saturday morning, with the Spirit continually prompting me to go home. I then began to feel ashamed to think that I had not obeyed the whisperings of the Spirit to me before. I took my team and started early on Saturday morning. When I arrived at Woodruff, the bishop urged me to stop until Monday and he would go with me. I told him, "No, I have tarried too long already." I drove on sprightly, and when within 15 miles of Wasatch, a furious snowstorm overtook me, the wind blowing heavily in my face. I mean, it's bad enough if you have a storm of that magnitude in a car or even a four-wheel drive, but can you imagine sitting out in the elements with a team, a horse, a covered wagon? I just can't even imagine that. In 15 minutes, I could not see any road whatever and knew not how or where to guide my horses. I left my lines loosely on my animals, went inside my wagon, tied down the cover, and committed my life and guidance into the hands of the Lord, trusting to my horses to find the way, as they had twice before passed over that road. I prayed to the Lord to forgive my sin in not obeying the voice of the Spirit to me and implored him to preserve my life. Now I want to stop here because we're going to hit this particular thing towards the end of the lesson. We often do things stupid. We often do stupid things. We know better, and then when we realize we did something stupid, we go to the Lord and we ask for his help, and he's always there to help us. He may not take away the problem, but he'll help us get through it. But he doesn't say, you were stupid, and because you were stupid, I'm not going to help. That is what is so beautiful about our relationship with the Lord. My horses brought me into the Wasatch train station at 9 o'clock in the evening with the hubs of my wagon dragging in the snow. I got my horses under cover and had to remain there until the next Monday night. Wow! He had to stay with the snow 6 feet deep on the level and still snowing. It was with great difficulty at last that I saved the lives of my horses by getting them into a railroad boxcar and taking them to Ogden. While if I had obeyed the revelation of the Spirit of God to me, I should have traveled to Salt Lake City over a good road without any storm. As I have received the good and the evil, the fruits of obedience and disobedience, I think I am justified in exhorting all my young friends to always obey the whisperings of the Spirit of God, and they will always be safe. If he had been obedient, he would have been protected. And that's what King Limhi is saying. If they hadn't broken their covenants, they would have protection from the Lamanites. Now I've got this wonderful missionary story. When we are obedient, we are better prepared to serve God and those around us. Two missionaries had spent an active day establishing a branch of the church in a remote village. At 5:30 that morning, they had taught a family before the husband left for the fields. Later, they had struggled to plaster their adobe walls to keep out blood-sucking insects. During the week, they had laid a small cement floor and had hung a 5-gallon can with a shower head to keep clean. They had begun a sanitation facility and put new gravel and sand in their water filter. For part of the day, they had worked beside men in the fields to later teach them. They were exhausted and ready for welcome rest. There came an anxious knock at the crude wooden door. A small girl was crying. She had been running and was gasping for air. They struggled to piece together her message, delivered amid sobs in a torrent of words. Her father had suffered a severe head injury while riding his donkey in the darkness. She knew he would die unless the elders saved his life. Men of the village were at that moment carrying him to the missionaries. She pled for her father's life, then ran to help him. The seriousness of their desperate situation began to engulf them. They were in a village with no doctors or medical facilities. There were no telephones. The only means of communication was a rough road up a riverbed, and they had no vehicle. The people of the valley trusted them. The missionaries were not trained in medicine. They did not know how to care for a serious head wound, but they knew someone who did. They knelt in prayer and explained their problem to an understanding Father in heaven. They pled for guidance, realizing that they could not save a life without his help. They felt impressed that the wound should be cleansed, closed, and the man given a blessing. One companion asked, "How will he stand the pain? How can we cleanse the wound and bless him while he is in such suffering?" They knelt again and explained to their father, "We have no medicine. We have no anesthetic. Please help us to know what to do. Please bless him, Father." As they arose, friends arrived with the injured man. Even in the subdued candlelight, they could see he had been severely hurt. He was suffering greatly. As they began to cleanse the wound, a very unusual thing occurred. He fell asleep. Carefully, anxiously, they finished the cleansing, closed the wound, and provided a makeshift bandage. As they laid their hands on his head to bless him, he awoke peacefully. Their prayer had been answered and his life saved. The trust of the people increased and a branch of the church flourished. When we keep our covenants and obey the commandments, we are entitled to receive promptings from the Spirit. This story was from a conference talk Elder Richard G. Scott gave in General Conference in April of 1989. And let's just play the very last part of that regarding these missionaries.
The missionaries were able to save a life because they trusted the Lord. They knew how to pray with faith for help with a problem they could not resolve themselves. Because they were obedient to the Lord trusted them and answered their prayer. They had learned how to recognize the answer when it came as a quiet prompting of the Spirit. You have that same help available to you as you live for it.
Okay, so now verse 33. But if ye will turn to the Lord with full purpose of heart and put your trust in him and serve him with all diligence of mind, if ye do this, he will, according to his own will and pleasure, deliver you out of bondage. And let's watch this from Elder Vaughn G. Keach. This, sorry, we'll watch this.
Some time ago, as I walked along the beach, I was enthralled by the magnificence of the large, crashing waves breaking just outside the bay, and the smaller waves rolling in closer to the shore. As I continued my stroll, I encountered a group of surfers. They were obviously upset about something, talking loudly and gesturing towards the sea. When I asked them what was wrong, they pointed to just outside the bay where the big waves were breaking. Look out there, one of them angrily told me. Can you see the barrier? Looking more closely now, I could indeed see a barrier. Stretching across the entire mouth of the bay, right where the large, enticing waves were breaking. We are here on a once-in-a-lifetime trip to surf these big waves. We can surf the smaller ones, breaking within the bay itself, but the barrier makes it impossible for us to surf the big ones. We have no idea why the barrier is there. All we know is that it has totally spoiled our trip. An older man seemed to be growing impatient as he listened to the ever-increasing complaints about the barrier. He pulled a pair of binoculars from his backpack and handed them to one of the surfers, pointing out towards the barrier. Each of the surfers looked through the binoculars. When my turn came, with the help of magnification, I could see something that I had not been able to see before. Dorsal fins. Large sharks feeding near the reef on the other side of the barrier. The old surfer retrieved his binoculars and turned to walk away. As he did, he said words I will never forget. Don't be too critical of the barrier, he said. It's the only thing that's keeping you from being devoured. Standing on that beautiful beach, our perspective had suddenly changed. A barrier that had seemed rigid and restricted, that seemed to curtail the fun and excitement of riding the really big waves, had become something very different. With our new understanding of the danger that lurked just below the surface, the barrier now offered protection, safety, and peace. As you and I walk the paths of life and pursue our dreams, God's commands and standards, like the barrier, can sometimes be difficult to understand. They may appear rigid and unyielding, blocking a path that looks fun and exciting and that is being followed by so many others. It is relatively easy to follow a course inside the barrier once we know that there are sharp-toothed predators swarming just outside of it. It is more difficult to keep our course within the barrier when all we can see are thrilling and tantalizing waves on the other side. As the Apostle Paul described, we see through a glass darkly, with such a limited perspective that we often cannot comprehend the great dangers hidden just below the surface. But he who comprehends all things gives us divine direction through his commands and loving guidance so that we may set a course in our lives that is protected from spiritual predators and the gaping jaws of sin. It is in those times when we choose to exercise our faith, put our trust in God, and show our love to him that we grow and gain the most. The Lord's commands do not constitute some grueling underwater maze of barriers that we must learn to grudgingly endure in this life so that we might be exalted in the next. The barriers established by the Lord create for us a safe harbor from the evil and destructive influences that would otherwise drag us down to the depths of despair. The Lord's commandments are given out of love and caring. They are intended for our joy in this life just as much as they are intended for our joy and exaltation in the next. They mark the way that we should act, and more importantly, they illuminate who we should become. True obedience, therefore, is giving ourselves entirely to him and allowing him to chart our course, both in calm waters and in troubled ones, understanding that he can make more of us than we could ever make of ourselves. To that end, he has charted for us a course leading back to him, and he has established barriers that will protect us along the way. As we do our best to follow that course, we find true safety, happiness, and peace. And as we submit to his will, we become what he wants us to become.
That was wonderful. What a great video about we are protected when we keep the commandments. Now let's move on to chapter 8. And it came to pass that he, Limhi, okay, caused that the plates which contain the record of his people from the time that they should, that they left the land of Zarahemla, should be brought before Ammon that he might read them. Now, as soon as Ammon had read the record, the king inquired of him to know if he could interpret languages, and Ammon told him that he could not. On the right is the record of Zenith. These are the plates that he's talking about. In verse 5, the large plates of Mosiah of Nephi were kept by Mosiah in Zarahemla, where he is in a different location. And they're different than these plates of this record of Zenith. Limhi's plates contain the record of his people from the days of King Zenith to his day. I know we're going to go into some flashbacks, and this part of the Book of Mormon can be confusing. And the king said unto him, being grieved for the afflictions of my people, I caused that 43 of my people should take a journey into the wilderness, that thereby they might find the land of Zarahemla, that we might appeal unto our brethren to deliver us out of bondage. And they were lost in the wilderness for the space of many days. Yet they were diligent and found not the land of Zarahemla, but returned to this land, having traveled in a land among many waters. So they left Shilom, and they were heading toward Zarahemla. They were trying to find it, but they failed. Having discovered a land which was covered with bones of men and of beasts, and was also covered with ruins of buildings of every kind, having discovered a land which had been peopled with a people who were as numerous as the hosts of Israel. And for a testimony that the things that they had said are true, they have brought 24 plates which are filled with engravings, and they are of pure gold. And behold, also they have brought breastplates, which are large, and they are of brass and of copper, and are perfectly sound. And again they have brought swords, the hilts thereof have perished, and the blades thereof were cankered with rust. And there is no one in the land that is able to interpret the language or the engravings that are on the plates. Therefore I said unto thee, canst thou translate? Now what is it they found? They found the remains of the Jaredite civilization. The Jaredites had settled there 3 centuries, 300 years before the Nephites arrived. And now Ammon said unto him, I can assuredly tell thee, O king, of a man that can translate the records, for he has wherewith that he can look and translate all records that are of ancient date, and it is a gift from God. And the things are called interpreters, and no man can look in them except he be commanded, lest he should look for that he ought not, and he should perish. And whosoever is commanded to look in them, the same is called seer. And behold, the king of the people who are in the land of Zarahemla is the man that is commanded to do these things, and who has this high gift from God. And the king said that a seer is greater than a prophet. And Ammon said that a seer is a revelator and a prophet also, and a gift which is greater can no man have, except he should possess the power of God, which no man can, yet a man may have great power given him from God. Whom do we sustain today as our prophets, seers, and revelators? Members of the First Presidency and the Quorum of 12 Apostles, they are our prophets, seers, and revelators. But a seer can know of things which are past, and also of things which are to come, and by them shall all things be revealed, or rather, shall secret things be made manifest, and hidden things shall come to light, and things which are not known shall be made known by them, and also things shall be made known by them which otherwise could not be known. Thus God has provided a means that man through faith might work mighty miracles. Therefore he becometh a great benefit to his fellow beings. And now when Ammon had made an end of speaking these words, the king rejoiced exceedingly and gave thanks to God, saying, doubtless a great mystery is contained within these plates. And these interpreters were doubtless prepared for the purpose of unfolding all such mysteries to the children of men. President Joseph Fielding Smith said, King Mosiah possessed 2 stones which were fastened into the 2 rims of a bow called by the Nephites interpreters, with which he translated the Jaredite record. And these were handed down from generation to generation for the purpose of interpreting languages. How Mosiah came into possession of these 2 stones, or Urim and Thummim, the record does not tell us, more than to say that it was a gift from God. Mosiah had this gift, or Urim and Thummim, before the people of Limhi discovered the record of Ether. They may have been received when the large stone was brought to Mosiah with engravings upon it, which he interpreted by the gift and power of God. They may have been given to him or to some other prophet before his day, just as the brother of Jared received them from the Lord. That the Urim and Thummim, or 2 stones, given to the brother of Jared were those in the possession of Mosiah appears evident. Joseph Smith received, with the breastplate and the plates of the Book of Mormon, the Urim and Thummim, which were hid up by Moroni to come forth in the last days as a means by which the ancient record might be translated, which Urim and Thummim were given to the brother of Jared. Isn't that something? The Urim and Thummim, which Joseph used in the translation of the Book of Mormon, not all the time, but he started out doing that. These were the same ones that King Mosiah had. Or it, not ones, the Urim and Thummim was a singular thing, but it's the same one. Isn't that remarkable? President Howard W. Hunter said, "A seer is one who sees. This does not mean that he sees through his natural eyes, but rather through his spiritual eyes. The seeric gift is a supernatural endowment." And he had it, President Hunter, when he was prophet. Why is a seer greater than a prophet? Let's watch this.
Ammon taught that seership is greater than prophethood. But what does it mean for a seer to be greater than a prophet? A prophet is someone who can, by the power of God, foretell what could happen if a person or people behaved in a certain way. In that very simple definition, we can see that though there are prophets called by God to stand at the head of His church, everyone can be a prophet in his or her own life. But seers stand apart from prophets in that they not only reveal God's will, but they can work mighty miracles through the means or tools provided by God. These means show us how Joseph Smith was both a prophet and seer. Through the divinely given Urim and Thummim and seer stone, Joseph was able to perform the miraculous work of translating the Book of Mormon. Prophets function as the mouthpiece of God, whereas seers are endowed with the power to perform miracles for the benefit of God's children. In this, seers are greater than prophets, and now you know why.
Verse 9. Well, do you think the discovery of these plates were an accident? Going back to verse 9. No, it wasn't. Right here in verse 9, 24 plates which are filled with engraving. So let's turn to the book of Ether. And the Lord, this is Ether chapter 15, verse 33. And the Lord spake unto Ether and said unto him, "Go forth." And he went forth and beheld that the words of the Lord had all been fulfilled. And he finished his record. And the hundredth part I have not written, and he hid them in a manner that the people of Limhi did find them later. It was not by accident that these people found it. Now, there are several flashbacks in the Book of Mosiah, and as we move into chapter 9, this is the first one. I like this flashback chart better. There's some that are so convoluted, I can't personally understand them. I know Tim can, but I can't. So chapters 9 through 22, they are the history of the people who left Zarahemla to return to the land of Nephi. And here's our Book of Mormon plate structure again. Mormon figured this was a good place to throw this in, right here where we are today. So he stops his abridgment of the large plates and adds the record of Zenith. So now Mormon is letting us read what happened to Zenith when he left Zarahemla. Now look at the chapter headings to chapter 9, and you'll see there's two. Now, the bottom one is what was written by Bruce R. McConkie for all of our chapter headings. But the top one was written by Mormon. And the phrase comprising chapters 9 to 22 inclusive was added when the Book of Mormon was published in chapter format in the 1879 edition. This was about the same time period that the kings Mosiah I, Benjamin, and Mosiah were reigning in the land of Zarahemla. Zenoph, Noah, and Limhi reigned in the land of the Lehi Nephite. They were at the south at the same time, so we can kind of understand what was going on. So now we go back 80 years to hear Zenoph's account. Okay, it's kind of like Ammon is there and he's reading this. King Limhi has just handed him this record, and now he's reading it. And now we're going to hear it. So the date for Mosiah chapter 8 is 121 BC. And the date for Mosiah 9 is 200 BC. The record reverted back in time 80 years to tell what happened in the land of Lehi Nephi during this time period of Benjamin and Mosiah's reign in Zarahemla. Okay, so here we are, Mosiah chapter 9, verse 1. I, Zenoph, having been taught in all the language of the Nephites, and having had a knowledge of the land of Nephi, or of the land of our father's first inheritance, and having been sent as a spy among the Lamanites, that I might spy out their forces, that our army might come upon them and destroy them, but when I saw that which was good among them, I was desirous that they should not be destroyed. Chapters 9 and 10 of Mosiah are evidently taken verbatim from a record originally prepared by Zenoph. Note that in these two chapters are written in the first person, I, Zenoph. It's not being narrated by a third person. So now we go back. Oh, I said that. Okay, sorry. Verse 2. Therefore, I contended with my brethren in the wilderness, for I would that our rulers should make a treaty with them. But he, being an austere and a bloodthirsty man, commanded that I should be slain. But I was rescued by the shedding of much blood, for father fought against father, and brother against brother, until the greater number of our army was destroyed in the wilderness, and we returned, those of us that were spared, to the land of Zarahemla to relate that tale to their wives and their children. And yet I, being overzealous, okay, I said, hang on to that, to inherit the land of our fathers. And I've highlighted this and put it in italics, because this is a big part of the story. Collected as many as were desirous to go up to possess the land, and started again on our journey into the wilderness to go up to the land. His grandson, Limhi, said if he wouldn't have been overzealous, we would not be here, subject in bondage to the Lamanites. Okay, but he was overzealous, and hey, I really still want to go do this. It was a bad idea from the get-go, and there is nothing in the scriptures that tells us the Lord approved of this venture. A subtle warning is presented in this verse. There is nothing wrong with being zealous, which means energetic, dynamic, dedicated, in a cause, but overzealousness can be dangerous and an example of strength becoming a weakness. Apparently, Zenoph was obsessed with the idea of resettling the old homeland, and he was blinded by the motives of the Lamanite king, who took advantage of him. Wisdom suggests that we avoid becoming overzealous and instead keep things in balance. And when we think we know more than the Lord and charge ahead with our own ideas instead of his, this is when it can lead to disaster. It's possible to be so focused on something we want that we make decisions without considering the possible consequences. And this is such a human trait. We all do it. We do something that we so later regret. So look at the last part of verse 3. For we were slow to remember the Lord our God. Where have we heard this before? Back in chapter 7, when King Limhi is speaking. So Zenith's grandson said, but behold, they would not hearken unto his words. The Lord had given his words to, okay, what he's talking about is his people. The Lord, they wouldn't listen to Abinadi's words. Remember when he's talking to King Noah? That's what he's saying. Now, they would not hearken. Look at the very first word in the Doctrine and Covenants. Hearken. O ye people of my church, saith the voice of him who dwells on high. Hearken is more than listening. It's like pay attention. It requires action. Wake up and pay serious attention. Apply my words to your life. Hearkening to the voice of the Lord brings rich blessings. If we hearken to the voice of the Lord, he will be quick to answer our prayers. We will be protected and magnified temporally. We will have the mercy and compassion of the Lord, and we will be delivered from death and have our place in mortality and immortality made secure. Not hearkening to the voice of the Lord can only bring the opposite of such blessings. Let's watch this from President Nelson.
To hearken means to hear him. To hear what the Savior says and then to heed his counsel. In those two words, hear him, God gives us the pattern for success, happiness, and joy in this life. We are to hear the words of the Lord, hearken to them, and heed what he has told us. As disciples of Jesus Christ, our efforts to hear him need to be ever more intentional. It takes conscious and consistent effort to fill our daily lives with his words, his teachings, his truths.
And he said, intentional. We need to be intentional in listening to the Lord and his words. So now Zenith continues with his story in chapter 9. And it came to pass that I went forth, that I went again, because I'm going to have my way. I'm really overzealous here and I'm going to go. It came to pass that I went again with four of my men into the city, in unto the king, that I might know of the disposition of the king, and that I might know if I might go in with my people and possess the land in peace. And I've shown this here on our little map. And I went in unto the king, and he covenanted with me that I might possess the land of Lehi-Nephi and the land of Shilom. If you look at the very back of the Book of Mormon, there is a pronunciation guide. That's why I say Zenith and not Zenith. And he also commanded that his people should depart out of the land. And I and my people went into the land that we might possess it. And we began to build buildings and we began to till the ground. King Laman began to grow uneasy, for in the 30th year of my reign, in the land of Nephi, away on the south of the land of Shilom, when my people were watering and feeding their flocks and tilling their lands, a numerous host of Lamanites came upon them and began to slay them and to take off their flocks and the corn of their fields. And it came to pass that I did arm them with bows and with arrows and with swords and with scimitars and with clubs and with slings and with all manner of weapons which we could invent. And I and my people did go forth against the Lamanites to battle. About this point, he knows he shouldn't have done this. It was a bad idea. Now, I've highlighted scimitars because critics of the Book of Mormon believe they weren't invented at that time. So let's watch this, which tells otherwise.
In an account of warfare in the Book of Mormon, Mormon wrote of the heavy blows of the Nephites with their swords and their scimitars, which brought death at almost every stroke. Some skeptical readers have claimed that the term scimitar in the text is out of place, since it was widely believed that such curved weapons were not invented at that time. However, it is now known that in various forms this weapon was known in both the Old World and the New World during Book of Mormon times. The scimitar is depicted in the ancient Near East as early as 2000 BC. In fact, curved swords may have been the most common sword in ancient Israel. Scimitar-like weapons are now known to have been used also in ancient pre-Columbian American warfare. Pre-Columbian monuments and codices show several kinds of curved knives and swords. Once thought to have arisen in the Western Hemisphere only long after Book of Mormon times, evidence now exists that scimitar-like weapons were used in Mesoamerica much earlier. The growing evidence for use of scimitars in ancient Mesoamerica during the time of the Book of Mormon is a striking confirmation of the accuracy of the Nephite account and suggests the need for patience and more careful study about any elements of the text that may at first seem strange to modern readers. And now you know why.
Verse 17, yea, in the strength of the Lord did we go to battle against the Lamanites, for I and my people did cry mightily to the Lord that he would deliver us out of the hands of our enemies, for we were awakened to a remembrance of the deliverance of our fathers. And God did hear our cries and did answer our prayers, and we did go forth in his might. Yea, we did go forth against the Lamanites, and in one day and a night we did slay 3,043. We did slay them even until we had driven them out of the land. Zenith recorded that they fought in the strength of the Lord when battling the Lamanites. Although Zenith's people were greatly outnumbered, they overcame their Lamanite aggressors with comparatively few casualties. Their success was due to their faithfulness to God. The Lord heard their cries and blessed them with strength. Throughout the Book of Mormon, we see that giving strength to his people is one of God's tender mercies. Zenith recorded that they fought in the strength of the Lord when battling the Lamanites. Although Zenith's people were greatly outnumbered, they overcame their Lamanite aggressors with comparatively few casualties. Their success was due to their faithfulness to God. The Lord heard their cries and blessed them with strength. Throughout the Book of Mormon, we see that giving strength to his people is one of God's tender mercies. I'm sorry, this is the same slide. Benjamin's people in Zarahemla were victorious over the Lamanites because they fought in the strength of the Lord. Now, I want to read another story about the Martin Hancock Company. Okay. Another example of somebody who shouldn't have done what they did, right? Absolutely should not have. It was too late in the year for them, and then an early snow just caught up with them. But they went anyway, and just like this story we've just read, well, let me read this. A teacher conducting a class said it was unwise ever to attempt, even to permit the Martin Handcart Company to come across the plains under such conditions. According to a class member, some sharp criticism of the church and its leaders was being indulged in for permitting any company of converts to venture across the plains with no more supplies or protection than a handcart caravan afforded. An old man in the corner sat silent and listened as long as he could stand it. Then he arose and said things that no person who heard him will ever forget. His face was white with emotion, yet he spoke calmly, deliberately, but with great earnestness and sincerity. In substance, he said, "I ask you to stop this criticism. You are discussing a matter you know nothing about. Cold historic facts mean nothing here, for they give no proper interpretation of the questions involved. Mistake to send the handcart company out so late in the season? Yes. But I was in that company, and my wife was in it, and Sister Nellie Unthank, whom you have cited, was there, too. We suffered beyond anything you can imagine, and many died of exposure and starvation. But did you ever hear a survivor of that company utter a word of criticism? Not one of that company ever apostatized or left the church, because every one of us came through with the absolute knowledge that God lives for we became acquainted with him in our extremities. I have pulled my handcart when I was so weak and weary from illness and lack of food that I could hardly put one foot ahead of the other. I have looked ahead and seen a patch of sand or a hill slope, and I have said I can go only that far, and there I must give up, for I cannot pull the load through it. I have gone on to that sand, and when I reached it, the cart began pushing me. I have looked back many times to see who was pushing my cart, but my eyes saw no one. I knew then that the angels of God were there. Was I sorry that I chose to come by handcart? No, neither then nor any minute of my life since. The price we paid to become acquainted with God was a privilege to pay, and I am thankful that I was privileged to come in the Martin Handcart Company. Should they have started out so late in the year? No, even he said that. Were they overzealous? Yes. But their journey must have been constantly filled with prayer. And as this man said, the Lord was with them the entire time. He won't take burdens away from us, okay? We know this. But especially burdens we get ourselves into when we are overzealous. But he will be there to help us get through. And the thing I love, as I said before, he will not say, sorry, you were stupid. You shouldn't have done it. I can't help you. When we call on him, we are mere mortals. He will be there. He will help us. I'm going to end the lesson with this beautiful video from Elder Bednar.
I have a dear friend who, in the early years of his marriage, was convinced he and his family needed a four-wheel drive pickup truck. His wife was sure that he did not need, but merely wanted, the new vehicle. A playful conversation between this husband and wife initiated their consideration of the advantages and disadvantages of such a purchase. "Sweetheart, we need a four-wheel drive truck." She asked, "Why do you think we need a new truck?" He answered her question with what he believed was the perfect response. What if we needed milk for our children in a terrible storm? And the only way I could get to the grocery store was in a pickup. His wife replied with a smile, "If we buy a new truck, we won't have money for milk." So why worry about getting to the store in an emergency? Over time, they continued to counsel together and ultimately decided to acquire the truck. Shortly after taking possession of the new vehicle, my friend wanted to demonstrate the utility of the truck and validate his reasoning for wanting to purchase it. So he decided he would cut and haul a supply of firewood for their home. It was in the autumn of the year, and snow already had fallen in the mountains where he intended to find wood. As he drove up the mountainside, the snow gradually became deeper and deeper. My friend recognized the slick road conditions presented a risk, but with great confidence in the new truck, he kept going. Sadly, my friend went too far along the snowy road. As he steered the truck off of the road at the place he had determined to cut wood, he got stuck. All four of the wheels on the new truck spun in the snow. He readily recognized that he did not know what to do to extricate himself from this dangerous situation. He was embarrassed and worried. My friend decided, "Well, I will not just sit here." He climbed out of the vehicle and started cutting wood. He completely filled the back of the truck with the heavy load. And then my friend determined he would try driving out of the snow one more time. As he put the pickup into gear and applied power, he started to inch forward. Slowly, the truck moved out of the snow and back onto the road. He finally was free to go home, a happy and a humbled man. Brothers and sisters, each of us also carries a load. Sometimes we mistakenly may believe that happiness is the absence of a load. But bearing a load is a necessary and essential part of the plan of happiness. We are not and never need be alone. We can press forward in our daily lives with heavenly help. Through the Savior's atonement, we can receive capacity and strength beyond our own.
I want to leave you with my testimony. There are so many beautiful lessons that we have touched on in these few chapters of Mosiah. We've learned that we have to rely on the Lord. And when we do, we are entitled to blessings. We are entitled to promptings from the Spirit. We covenant every Sunday. And He will have his Spirit will be with us. And we know that even though if we get overzealous and buy a new truck, because we got to have that new truck even though we didn't need it, and I know better, the Lord, I'm sure this man must have prayed or been prompted, just get the wood. It's the weight will get you out. But he learned a valuable lesson. And the Savior was there. The Savior will always be with us, even if we charge forward and do something stupid. And I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.